You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. Can you hear me? Is it on? Very good. My name is Mwangi Kemenyi. I'm a senior fellow and director of the Africa Growth Initiative here at Brookings. And on behalf of my colleagues at the Africa Growth Initiative and Brookings, I would like to welcome you to this forum on release of the this is the first African Human Development Report, and it's really appropriate that it's focusing on food security, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. As we know, there is the Global Human Development Report, and then there has also been the production of country human development reports. But this is the first time that UNDP has released a specific report for the entire Africa. Most of us who study development know that food security is actually critical. And if you follow the approach to the human development approach, the one that looks at human capabilities, you know that the issue of food security is at the center of the development when you focus on the people themselves. I've been reflecting on this, and I'm pretty happy today that that we have a distinguished panel here. And I was also involved at some point in discussing this report when it was in process. So I'm glad that we are able to launch it, this report here. At the Africa Growth Initiative, we've been focusing a lot on economic growth, and agriculture has been one of the core areas that we look at, which is as a driver for economic growth. And as you travel through Africa and as you read news, you know that this is a continent with vast potential. Yet it's also the continent that you get not just hunger, but also you get malnutrition in terms of nutrients. But also it's also, as a paradox, it's also the country where other countries are going to invest on land for their own use. Most of you have heard the idea of the land grab, the huge land leases, which countries are coming, some of them investing and taking the output directly out of the continent. So it's sort of a paradox that we still talk about food security in Africa, yet other people still come to this continent to invest for their own purpose. Most of this food is not actually entering the African market, but is going to other continents. So I find that as a paradox in many ways. I'm sure these issues will come at some point. We have a distinguished panel here to discuss this report and also giving their own perspectives. And what I'll do is introduce all of them. Then I'll ask the first presenter, the person, Pedro, to come and actually give us a brief presentation, and then the others will make comments, and then we'll open up to discussion. I'll start with Pedro Conceicao. That's fine. That's again, I was happy to see Pedro because we worked a little bit together in terms of reviewing this report. Who is a chief economist and head of the strategic and advisory unit at UNDP's Regional Bureau for Africa. He previously served as a regional director of UNDP's Office of Development Studies, where he worked on the impact of the global economic crisis on developing countries, the food crisis, climate change and development, and the evolution of income distribution in the developing world. Previously, he was an assistant professor at the Technical University of Lisbon, Portugal, teaching and researching on science, technology, and innovation policy. Those are issues that will be coming up quite frequently on technology issues and innovation. Then we have Beth Danford, who is the director of the Office of Country Strategies and Implementation in the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, Bureau for Food Security, where she is also acting as deputy assistant to the administrator. She is responsible for overseeing the Bureau's technical and regional expertise focused on improving food security and reducing persistent rural poverty. From 2009 to 2010, Danford served as the senior development advisor to Ambassador Holbrook, the Secretary of State Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. In this capacity, she provided strategic direction and implementation guidance to reorient development programs in Afghanistan and Pakistan in support of the president's counterinsurgency objectives. Prior to this assignment, she was the team leader for Afghanistan on the U.S. Central Command assessment established by the Bureau, by General Petraeus. Finally, but not least, is Eugene Terry. Eugene is one person that I started working with when I realized his deep knowledge of agriculture in Africa and himself coming from Africa. He is currently a senior technical advisor of Transfarm Africa, an organization which partners with mid-sized private sector actors to identify and remove systematic barriers to investing and managing African agriculture business. Eugene has held leadership positions in international institutions, including that of the first Director General of West African Rice Development Association, now the Africa Rice Center, and Land Crops Advisor in the Agriculture and Rural Development Department of the World Bank, and Founding Director, the Africa Agricultural Technology Foundation, AATF in Nairobi, Kenya. So you can see there have been very broad knowledge of agriculture. Now, just a few comments. One, before I ask Pedro to come and make the presentation, this is a public forum, so everything is recorded that you are saying. So don't say you didn't say it. Next, when we start the question time, what we like is to really to focus on these issues discussed here or left, but please be brief as you approach the podium. So I'll ask Pedro to start on the presentation. Pedro.
Thank you, Mwangi, and thank you, everybody, for coming. I'm very grateful for this opportunity to present the report and looking forward to the discussion that will follow with the colleagues here in the panel and with all of you. This report is really in two parts. It focuses first on a diagnostic of where do we stand when it comes to food security in Africa. And then in the second part of the report, it looks into a number of policy recommendations. So I'll go through the main findings of the report in these two dimensions very briefly, and we'll try to leave a lot of the details for the discussion that will follow. And in terms of the diagnostic, our departure point was really the paradox between the economic performance that we've seen in a lot of African countries, in most African countries actually, over the last 10 years, which really marks a turnaround when we look at what happened up to 2000 or so. And you can see in the chart that economic growth rates in Africa were quite volatile up until the year 2000 or so. Often negative. These are GNI per capita growth rates, average for the continent. But over the last 10 years, rates have been always positive and less volatile. You see a little bit of a drop that has happened as a result of the global economic and financial crisis around the year 2008. But other than that, economic growth rates in Africa have been quite high and relatively stable. And they have actually been higher than in many parts of the world, as you see when you compare the growth rates in Africa, the green line with the dashed line, which are the growth rates in the rest of the world, excluding the fast-growing economies in East Asia. And this growth has also been quite widespread. To a large extent, it has to do with the commodity price boom that occurred up until 2008 or so. But it went beyond that. It has actually, it has been registered, high growth has been registered in a number of countries that are not rich in mineral resources, in oil, and it has been quite widespread. Now, this hopeful story, positive story of Africa contrasts with what has happened when it comes to food security. And just as an illustration of where we stand, if we look at the rates of undernourishment, the prevalence of undernourishment, that is the number of people that are not able to have enough calories to lead a normal life, more than 1 in 4 people in Africa are still not able to get enough calories to lead a normal life. And the map shows that in many African countries, these rates are, these prevalence rates are much, much higher. In many countries, over 1/3 of the population cannot meet the minimum caloric needs. So there is a bit of a paradox here between the positive story that we've seen in Africa over the last 10 years and the relative lack of progress when it comes to food security. So this was the main motivation for us to go into this topic in this Human Development Report. The first, as Mwangi said, that looks specifically into Africa. So the question is why? And the reason is really not that there isn't proper conditions in Africa to grow food. Mwangi has already alluded to this fact also. There is enough fertile land, there is enough water, and there's a climate that generally favorable to growing food. So the analysis in the report suggests that the problem has really to do mostly with policies, with misguided policies, both in Africa and in the international context. And these policies are underpinned by a set of institutions and a lack of political commitment that have not given enough attention to the problem of food security, or that resulted in a number of policies that have led to the vulnerability when it comes to food security that we see today in Africa. So the premise of the report is that policies have to change. And when the analysis of the report look at policies, it looked at other regions in the world, other developed regions that have done well, that have overcome some of the challenges that Africa still faces today when it comes to food security. But the situation in Africa today is very different from the situation that Asia and Latin America, for example, faced in the 60s and 70s when they started to invest massively in overcoming the problems of food security. And there are in particular three new challenges or two new contextual factors that we have to take into account when we think of policies. The first has to do with the demography. The demographic pressures in the continent are very, very high and are going to increase. The chart shows that around 2050, sub-Saharan Africa will have 2 billion people. It now has less than 1 billion people. So the number of mouths to feed will increase dramatically. And you'll see also in the chart that half of the population in Africa will be young, will be under 24 years of age. So there is this combination of a very large and very young population that we need to face over the next few decades. Secondly, there are dramatic changes in the international food system. You see in the chart that looks into international food prices that these prices for a while have been quite stable. But we all know the spike in food prices that occurred in 2008. Last year, we saw also an increase in international food prices. And as we speak, it looks like we are going to face probably another big spike in food prices related to the drought that we're seeing in the United States. Certainly when it comes to maize, the situation when it comes to wheat is a little bit more positive, it looks like, because stocks are still there. But all of this reflects this volatility, these spikes in food prices, that the international food system is changing, is different from what it was when international food prices were low. And this reflects both shocks to the supply side as well as changes in the demands. The demand is changing with emerging economies changing their consumption patterns when it comes to food, consuming much more meat and dairy products as opposed to grain-based food. The investment in biofuels that competes with some cropland. And as I mentioned also on the supply side, we've seen that the international food system is much more vulnerable to shocks like droughts, like the one we're witnessing in the U.S. today. And these shocks are likely, and this is the third challenge, actually to become worse as time goes on as a result of climate change. So environmental pressures are likely to head up to the challenges. So this basically concludes the diagnostic part of the report. And to summarize, what we've seen is growth in Africa, lack of progress when it comes to food security, a need to change policies, important to look into what other countries have done, but as we look into other countries, also recognize the new challenges that emerge that have to do with demography, changes in the international food price system, and environmental pressures, and most of all, climate change. So policies now, the second part of the report. And I'll run through this fairly quickly so that we then have time during the discussion to go into a little bit more depth. Four policy recommendations. First, the absolute imperative to increase agriculture productivity. During the production of the report, we felt that there was a bit of a confusion between how to really address the challenge of food security, whether it was enough to just produce more food, if the focus should be on production and making food available. But the challenge is really one of increasing agriculture productivity. And you'll see in the chart that agriculture productivity, the green line that represents cereal yields in Africa, has been stagnant when in comparison with what has happened in Asia and in South America. And the interesting thing about agriculture productivity is that it is beneficial not only to the extent that it makes more food available, but it is also a very powerful instrument for reducing poverty, for generating income, and for generating employment and job opportunities. This was the dynamics that we've seen in Asia, certainly in Asia, in the 70s, late 70s, when there were these sharp increases in agriculture productivity, when a large segment of the labor force lives in rural areas and poverty rates are very high. Poverty rates in Africa now, on average, people living in extreme poverty on less than a dollar a day are 48%. So almost half of the population lives in extreme poverty in Africa. So in these circumstances, agriculture productivity is a major engine, not only of making more food available, but of making more income available and making employment opportunities available also. I won't go through the detailed policy recommendations. As I mentioned, we can leave this into the for the discussion. Second set of policy recommendations has to do with nutrition. Again, during the production of the report, the analysis suggests that nutrition has been a neglected area when it comes to policy making. There's a lot of emphasis on producing enough food or making enough food available, making enough calories available, but that is not enough. There are, beyond calories, other elements that are important for people to function and especially for children to learn and to grow into productive adults. So a focus on nutrition is essential, and we've seen that in some countries, even though progress has been made when it comes to providing enough calories, we are lagging when it comes to nutrition, certainly in Africa. And this suggests a need for a focused effort on nutrition policies. Nutrition policies, there are a range of nutrition interventions that are very, very cost-effective, but have been neglected. And so the report suggests that it's important to make nutrition an integral part of efforts to address food security. Third is the resilience agenda. Often the challenges of food insecurity in Africa have to do with instability in food systems, instabilities that are produced by a number of shocks, be it natural disasters, weather shocks, conflict. And so the report suggests that it's very important to emphasize, to have policies that increase the resilience of families, of societies, of economies in Africa. And there are two sets of recommendations here. One that has to do with looking at the sources of instability and try to work to reduce the sources of instability. And the second side is shocks will be there anyway, and some of them come from outside the continent, and there's little that countries can do to prevent those. The ability to cope with shocks. And in this dimension, we emphasize, the report emphasized the importance of social protection measures, not only to protect the vulnerable population, but also as an instrument to enhance risk management. Again, we'll go over the details later in the discussion. The final element has to do with empowerment. Empowerment is central to the human development approach. Every human development report, be it national, global, often has a strong focus on empowerment. Empowerment means giving people more control over their lives. And it's intrinsically important, but the report looks into the instrumental value also of empowerment when it comes to making people more food secure, and in particular, the benefits of empowering women. And this basically closes the loop when we compare, when we recall the diagnostic that had to do with policies. If policies were at the heart of the problem in Africa, empowering the population to make leaders more accountable to their aspirations has to be really central to the agenda to improve food security. So this is really it when it comes to recommendations. The report may disappoint some because it's a little bit complex and it doesn't offer, you know, sound bite, slogan like silver bullet recommendations. It's a little bit complex, but that's what the analysis suggests, that the problem of food security in Africa is challenging. It requires interventions across a range of sectors. That it's important to elevate the level of decision making that looks into this range of policies to ensure that they are all coordinated. It's not okay to just leave it to the agriculture minister when it comes to agriculture productivity, or to leave it only to the health minister when it comes to nutrition, for example. It's really important to look into the connections, to see the linkages between these sets of policy actions. And that's what UNDP is trying to put forward with the analysis in the report, is really the importance of connecting the dots and to elevate the level of attention to this issue. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be an easy challenge to overcome food insecurity. But with effort, with focus, it will be possible to translate the growth that has occurred in Africa over the last 10 years and to unleash a new cycle of not only rapid growth, but rapid improvements in human development as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, as we wait for someone to put the microphone, I'll ask Beth to make the remarks.
Great, thank you very much. That was a very, very useful introduction of the report, and I appreciate that. So I'm happy to be here today and talking about food security. And as was mentioned, I'm Beth Dunford. I'm from the U.S. Agency for International Development, from the Bureau for Food Security. And we're the lead on implementing President Obama's Feed the Future initiative. So this is a subject that that interests us greatly, and we're so happy to see so much attention around food security these days. So I'm a Deputy Assistant Administrator of the Bureau for Food Security, and I head up our office that's in charge of our country programs, focusing on strategy, our program implementation, and technical thought leadership in agriculture and nutrition food security. So I just want to say again, to reiterate, that it's a heartening sign that we're all gathered here today discussing one of the most important and pressing issues affecting Africa and many other parts of the world. And this is the same sense of awe that also hit me just before the G8 summit at Camp David, how far we've really come in establishing the critical role that food security plays in all aspects of life. And for those of us who have worked on agriculture for a long time, recognizing that declining budgets, declining attention to this area, we're really seeing a reversal of that trend, and it's very, very important. At the symposium held by the Chicago Council on Global Affairs in May, prior to the G8 summit, for what was probably the first time in a very, very long time, we had the President of the United States, we had the Secretary of State, and several heads of state from African countries, all together, as well as many other leading voices on this issue, gather together to highlight and push for key food security agenda items. And I think it says a lot about the efforts of many of you in this room that have really raised the profile of food security, and I want to thank you for that. And so, as we said, that the Bureau for Food Security, where I work, is the lead for implementing President Obama's Feed the Future initiative, which many of you know. It's our U.S. government contribution to the broader G8 and G20 agenda, such as starting with the G8 meetings in L'Aquila in 2009, where we really saw sort of the beginning of this resurgence of attention on agriculture on the global donor stage. And we saw at the L'Aquila summit, agreement between public sector actors on the part of the African governments. We saw commitment to producing country-led plans, commitment to putting more of their resources towards agriculture, 10% of the government budget as a target, and then agreement on both sides for mutual accountability and increased transparency. On the donor side, we saw a commitment to increased funding, sustainable commitments, and again, showing transparently through results-based practices what we were accomplishing. And so these principles that came out of the Rome-based principles upon which Feed the Future are based is investing, one, in country-owned plans that support results-based programs, which I think is a huge improvement in how we'd been operating before, strengthening strategic coordination globally, regionally, and locally, and ensuring a comprehensive approach, which is agriculture and nutrition, and increasing the impacts of humanitarian food assistance, looking at this all together, four, leveraging the benefits of multilateral institutions, and five, delivering on sustained and accountable commitments, which was the big part of the donor pledge at L'Aquila in 2009. So building on this, when we have the U.S. has a presidency for the G8 at the summit that was recently happened in Camp David and at the Chicago Council event the day before, President Obama launched the New Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition. And what this does is it takes the public sector commitments made between African governments and donors at L'Aquila in 2009, which were very, very important and a huge step forward, and really brings in the missing third piece of this, which is the private sector, recognizing that public sector resources and energy alone is not enough to transform and revitalize the agriculture sector. And what we saw was with these three players, private sector, African heads of state, and G8 donor partners, each making commitments on the table, African governments putting on the table concrete, time-bound policy reforms to improve the enabling environment to better enable the private sector to invest in their countries. Very, very specific reforms that we codified in cooperation frameworks that are available on the feedthefuture.gov website from Ghana, Tanzania, and Ethiopia. Then on the donor side, really focusing on sustained commitments to priority areas of government-owned and government-led plans. And then on the private sector side, letters of intent detailing what their intention was to invest in that country in agriculture. And so I think bringing these three things together through the G8 has been a very, very exciting, exciting proposition that builds on existing efforts of the CADEP and the country implementation plans for agriculture and really fuels investment in certain areas by bringing in the private sector. And I just wanted to go into a little bit of what sorts of what we saw from this is that we were able to put on the table just at the G8 summit, and of course there are many more that are coming forward, but 45 private sector firms from large multinational companies like Yara International to small local businesses like Ethiopia's Omega Farms have stepped forward to commit to invest more than $3 billion in African agriculture. This is building on a decade of strong leadership from African countries, again, committing to the specific policy reforms that will enable that investment. One of the great things about this new alliance is that we're seeing it, again, come from large multinationals and also African-owned companies. For example, Rabobank intends to launch a lending facility in West Africa that would provide up to $135 million in loans over 5 years to small and medium enterprises. Small and medium-sized companies in the region which participate in the agricultural value chain, ranging from production, processing, logistics, to services and technology. Another example, Tanseed, which is a local Tanzanian company, is committed to training contract growers in certified seed production, leading to an estimated $11 million in additional sourcing from local seed, certified seed contract growers, and really using a different methodology with smaller bags of seed that are more appropriate for smallholders, that are 0.25 to 2 kilograms of seeds, of improved seeds that smallholders can then more easily access. And again, with these funds, when these funds are invested behind country-driven plans that align with countries' own priorities in agriculture, we can expect large gains for smallholder farmers that will help increase their resilience to food price spikes, as well as other disturbances that can affect access or availability to food. And before I stop, I just wanted to note the importance of integrating nutrition into this work and how that fits into the new alliance framework. The G8 has pledged support to the scaling of nutrition movement, the SUN movement that many of you know, as well as to encourage the commitment of African partners to improve the nutritional well-being of their populations, especially during the 1,000-day window from pregnancy to a child's second birthday. And through this, the G8 members pledged to maintain robust programs to further reduce child stunting and to support the efforts of African institutions, civil society, private sector partners to establish regional nutritional learning centers. So that's the gist of how the new alliance will work. Hopefully we can get into more of it in the discussion if it comes up. We're excited about it. We're working hard on all the ways the U.S. will contribute to this through Feed the Future. And we're looking forward to leveraging these new investments from private sector partners for the benefit and well-being of smallholders in Africa who need it most. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We are supposed to be wired by now, but I don't know what's going on. So you speak from the podium.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I have 7 minutes to give an African perspective. I will highlight some 4 or 5 key take-home messages that I will build around 9 or 10 key points and key submissions. First and foremost, the Human Development Report proposes 4 action areas, and Pedro has already mentioned these 4. Just reiterate them. Sustainable ag productivity increases, effective nutrition policies, resilient communities and households, and empowerment of the rural poor. I will speak only about the first, sustainable productivity increases, and the fourth, empowerment. But I will try to link these to livelihoods, food security, and poverty reduction. There are statistics which I'm sure some of you already have. There are 450 million small farms in the non-OECD countries of the world. The bulk of them are in China, the Indian subcontinent, and in Africa. The farm sizes are approximately about 2 hectares, and agricultural production on these farms provide livelihoods for 2.3 billion people, roughly one-third of mankind. Therefore, the people who make their livelihoods from these smallholder units are not going away. They're going to be with us for quite a while. And their income generation capacity and food security challenges must be addressed. The way forward, as has been suggested, is to sustainably intensify their production through various interventions, value creation, value chain promotion, innovations, use of productivity enhancing technologies, farm services, and progressive trade and infrastructure policies. Above all, link to markets. We will come back to markets later. Public sector partnerships with private sector can create the knowledge base and other support systems and programs for technology development. Those partnerships are ongoing, and they are growing, and they're getting much more effective and much more efficient. These partnerships also help to promote seed systems, extension, credit, market information, crop insurance schemes, biosafety regimes, all those things which come under the rubric of enabling environment. There are some interesting new value chain models that are emerging. One such is the producer-driven model, where the public sector, essentially governments, NGOs, foundations, and here I must give recognition and credit to a foundation known as Syngenta Foundation for Sustainable Agriculture, with which I work and on whose board I serve. These public sector unit organizations are already providing support for smallholders directly. They promote farmer service organizations, cooperatives, mechanisms to lower users' costs, aggregation of products for deals with buyers, volume purchases, discounting of inputs, and guarantee schemes. These are all areas in which the public sector is providing support for the smallholder within the context of enabling environment. However, there are other new challenges and other new opportunities which I imagine. One such is the large investor, large-scale farming initiative that some will put under the rubric of land grab. I prefer to use other terminology, but I think we all know what we're talking about. However, here is where there is need for a cautionary note. We must be very careful what we ask for. Africans, for a long time, have been asking for investment in agriculture in Africa. I say that there are challenges in this scenario, especially with the large-scale investments, because of the need to guide the regulatory processes and the evolution of these investor-driven models. It is imperative that these models, when they're developed, lead to improved livelihoods and food security for the rural and urban poor. In 2009, nearly 60 million hectares of land, an area equal to the size of France, were leased or purchased by large investors for ag production in Africa. If well regulated, these investments offer opportunities for the public and private sectors in partnership to adopt and promote what is now usually called a commercial farming cluster approach. And the essential elements of this is that you have a holding consisting of perhaps 1,000 to 5,000 hectares, which is the nucleus farm unit, with smallholder outgrower schemes attached. The investors invest in infrastructure. They provide services to farmers, inputs, credit, equipment. They facilitate quality and post-harvest handling. In one such scheme in Ghana, for rice, they provide milling equipment. And the public sector, which is a partner in this initiative, assists with linkages with agro dealers, with standards and compliance protocols, and training and market links and branding and other, in other words, knowledge, information, and skills. So that's where I want to end my presentation in terms of knowledge, information, and skills. I believe that CADAP has recognized the need for a robust knowledge, information, and skill support system to empower smallholders to face these new challenges and opportunities. There is the urgent need to establish what has been proposed as a three-tier system of KIS, again, knowledge, information, and skills, at the national, regional, and continental levels. I had a brief word with Mwangi at the beginning of this session, where I thought it might be useful. It might be a useful initiative for the Africa Growth Initiative to take a look at and see how they can assist in establishing and creating these case units at national and regional levels. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. As the others wired, I did want to, I think Terry's comments on the land leases, and I'm sure some of this will come up, and since I started, I mentioned this at the beginning, maybe we need to distinguish straight investments that also supply food to the communities versus some of these investments where you get these foreign farms come and they invest, they lease large tracts of land. They actually sometimes bring their own labor, as I'm told, and capital, but extremely no linkages with the local economies. So that what they do is for their own economies. I think we need to make a distinction between that versus where you have the linkages that Eugene has actually talked about. And maybe at some point that will come up. Again, based on my thinking on this. So the land grab that I mentioned is the bad one versus the good investments. So I open up this discussion for questions and comments, and I would appreciate if you are very brief, straight to the point, so that we can take a couple of questions. And then you can direct the question to an individual, but we'll try to circulate and we'll take three at a time. I'll start with the gentleman here and the lady. And please say your name and organization affiliation.
My name is Paulo Rodas. I am from Guatemala, but I am a member of the new presidential committee, advisory committee of the government of Malawi. Regarding Mr. Conciao's presentation, he proposed four main issues. But when you take a map of Africa, you will see always that any economic and social indicators is much worse, usually is much worse for the landlocked countries. In the northwest, in the north, and in the south. And for these countries, regarding this issue of food and agriculture, to import any food is much more expensive, and to export is also much more expensive. I didn't see any mention about landlocked countries. Do you have any mention about this? Because there are landlocked countries in Latin America, like Bolivia or Paraguay, and there are in Asia. But in Africa, there are many, and they are very, very poor, most of them. Okay. Did you deal with this in the report or not?
Good. Thank you. Let's take the lady. We'll take about three, four questions. So that's the issue of the landlocked
Good
questions.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen.
Be brief, yeah.
Yeah. My name is Rosemary Seguero. I'm the president of Hope for Tomorrow. I'm based here in Washington, D.C., an organization that focuses on women in Africa. As you know, Africa women are the more powerful in agriculture. I've heard about you speak about rural development. U.S. has given so much money in rural countries of Africa. What happens to this money? Where does the money go? And how can we collaborate with you as a USA-based organization, working with women in the rural area, in the farms where women are the backbone of agriculture in Africa? How can we work with you, guys?
Thank you. Mr. Freeman, please, over there.
Thank you. Lawrence Freeman, African desk of ER Magazine. The paradox that the first speaker mentioned is not a paradox to me, where most of your institutions are measuring the wrong values. You're measuring housing in Lagos, you're measuring the banking sector. If you measure the physical economy, which includes people, there is no growth in Africa. Look at 125 million people in Nigeria, South Sudan, the Congo, the Sahel, and the Horn, which are facing famines. So if you measure energy, food production, rail production, there's no growth. So the question is, why do we have this food crisis? We didn't have this as bad in the 60s and 70s and 80s when countries were almost self-sufficient. You have globalization destroying and driving down the price and the production, and you have a consistent policy from the international institutions to not build the infrastructure. And that's where the Food for Peace program falls short. You need massive development in energy, rail, and water, and it should be countrywide, regional-wide, and continental-wide. And it should be done by the governments publicly doing it, hiring the private sector, but it should be public credit with help of the world, which has not come yet. And that's why we're facing genocidal proportions of death in Africa.
Okay, thanks. I'll ask the gentleman at the corner to be the last one, then we get those questions. Again, be brief and to the point.
Sure. Salifu Kamara, I'm from Sierra Leone. I'm a student at American University and currently intern with Open Society Foundation. As I was growing up, one thing what I used to heard was about development. Even when I moved back to the United States, I still, you know, as a student, I began to learn about the World Bank and how the World Bank was started many years ago and focusing on development, and also about the United States supporting African countries with billions of dollars. But this is the question. Why all these names, these big names, but yet still the achievement has never been, there's no achievement, there's no solution. Does the problem lie to the policy making? And one thing I also begin to investigate is that most of the international companies that's going to Africa, how do these policies affect them? Do these policies have a bite and because what I'm learning is that most of these companies are really not taking up their corporate responsibilities, and yet still they keep on defining the word Africa as a poverty country, Africa as a food security issues. So these policies has to affect them in order to be able to achieve a solution to the issues that we all want to see.
Okay, we'll get very brief responses. Some of them are comments, and which are agreeable. So why don't we start with Pedro just for comments, particularly on the rad dogs issues.
Thank you. No, we do actually look a lot into the issue that you've raised. In the context of the, it has been mentioned also by other interventions and by some colleagues as well from the floor, the problem of infrastructure, of connecting farmers with markets. And these problems are more acute in landlocked countries, as you put it. In landlocked countries, it's more expensive, African landlocked countries, more expensive to buy fertilizer than in the US and in Europe, which is really that's a paradox, really. It shouldn't be that way. Mm-hmm. And this is linked to the lack of infrastructure. The lack of infrastructure to have access to inputs, and the lack of infrastructure also to sell the output of farmers. There are many stories in Africa, I don't know if you've heard, of people starving in a village and not very far away, food rotting. Mm-hmm. Food. Why? I mean, this is because there is no connection between markets, people and markets, mm-hmm. farmers and markets. And in the recommendations, I don't know if you saw one of the bullet points that was in the slide, was precisely about infrastructure. Mm-hmm. The importance of investing in infrastructure, in rural infrastructure, in roads, in storage, also in credit, in insurance. Sometimes the problems are not technological when it comes to increasing productivity. It's about making markets function, work, and investment in infrastructure is critical, especially for landlocked mm-hmm. countries. The comment on measuring the wrong thing, yes, it's true. GDP growth is a very imperfect measure for well-being, as we all know. But I would be a little bit more optimistic, I guess. I would suggest that there have been some improvements also in some human development indicators. For example, if you look at the Human Development Index, which is also an imperfect indicator, but it combines income with measures of life expectancy and education, Africa has also been doing quite well, improving quite rapidly. The challenge is that it comes from a very low level. So if you look at levels, Africa is still, most African countries are still very low. It is correct that in the 60s, even in regions that we are now facing acute food crisis year after year, like the Sahel, in the 60s in the Sahel, the Sahel was self-sufficient. Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso, these countries were self-sufficient. So what has happened in Africa in the 60s and 70s was that there was this huge increase in population. driven in part by high fertility rates, also by improvements in child and infant mortality. And there wasn't the commensurate investment in increasing agricultural productivity. So there was this this shock of the demography and the lack of investment in agriculture that has led over many years to the situation that we have had now. So that's why we put so much emphasis on the importance of increasing agricultural productivity. And a lot can be done in Africa and by policies in Africa.
Thank you very much. I think there are two questions which may not be quite specific, but the first one is directed to that US has put a lot of resources to Africa, but she sort of doesn't think it's doing the right thing. And then Eugene could focus on the last question on what are these investors doing. Okay.
So I wanted to wholeheartedly agree of the importance of women in agriculture in Africa. I think that we're focused on, when you're focusing on smallholders, you're focusing on women because they're the majority of the farmers in Africa. And I think that if you look at our programs, definitely how we're addressing gender is a common theme throughout. Yeah. I think it's also shown as an importance in the empowerment section of your report, really making sure that women have access to these new technologies. Land tenure is a very big issue in the rest. And so we wholeheartedly agree. We're working on it. We welcome broader partnership. I think if you look in the feedthefuture.gov website, there's lots of different ways to get engaged with different programs we have across the world. And we agree and look forward to creative ideas on how to move that forward.
Thank you. Eugene?
Yes, I suspected that this issue of the investor-driven model would provoke quite a few questions, and I think that is to be expected. One of the first questions that one should pose is what kind of a model is being adopted in these countries? What are the rules and regulations that guide the development of these models? What is the level of transparency in developing those rules and regulations? When the deals are made, who are the ones sitting around the table? Is it the ones who are going to be affected by this, or those who just want to benefit from perhaps inducement money that is passed under the table? So these are all issues that I think are very important, but I think central to all of this is we've got to be able to determine what kind of a model we want to see developed for this that will benefit both the investor and those who are going to participate in the scheme for which the investors are willing to put the money.
Okay,
so
thank
you. It's an open question, and there is a lot of debate down the road, and I would recommend that you take a look at the Oakland Institute Against Investment in Agriculture, and they have frequently asked questions which I think are the kinds of questions that some of you might want to pose and see if we can get answers to those questions.
Very good. I want to start from the back and then come up to this lady. So that lady there, that person next to you. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Resor from the AAAS, and I wanted to go back to the question of land grabbing a little bit more. Specifically, maybe for USAID, I wonder how the U.S., as it's courting the private market so strongly, is trying to set up some checks and balances so that they're not just creating more land grabbing opportunities.
Okay, and please speak louder when you get the microphone. Okay, come to that lady there next to you, and then forward.
Good morning, and thank you. My name is Cynthia Bunton. I have my own consulting firm.
Could you?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
My name is Cynthia Bunton, and I have my own consulting firm. I was wondering, in looking at the very comprehensive UNDP report, how great a role governance and governance training will play in your proposed solutions to food security.
Very good. Yeah, the next one there. So I come up to this. Yeah.
Hi, Hi, my name is Anna Gobler. I'm a student at George Washington University and intern at UNDP office in Washington. So you mentioned increasing food prices. So do the international capital markets influence the food prices really so much as it's told? Thank you.
Okay, this one, this lady. So,
thank you very much, and good morning. I also am at GW. It's nice to see another person here. So the four points that you raise, which are interesting, are in many ways not at all new, right? So the idea that you would increase ag productivity, you deal with nutrition and social protection and empowerment of women, at least for the past decade, have been the main talking points of the FAO and through the 1950s, at least for ag production, but not to a whole lot of avail. In part, I think, because food, even when you grow it, when you increase productivity, will go to where it can make the most profit, which is not where people are traditionally most malnourished. In part because agriculture produces pretty harsh work climates that don't yield livable wages often. So in the United States, Fresno has the highest, is the county of the highest agricultural production, thanks to Brookings, also has the highest rates of malnutrition and poverty. So in the middle of agricultural plenty, you often see this. Mm-hmm. So the question would be, in advocating these four things again, what safeguards can be put into place to ensure that when you grow more food, it actually stays and goes to who needs it? And that if you're using agriculture as an industry for employment purposes, how do you assume or assure livable wages? And can there be any leverage with the rights framework here? So using food as a right, is can you gain leverage on that framework?
Okay. Pedro and then Ben.
Okay.
I think we have plenty of.
so many just questions. Quickly, yeah. Let me just focus on a few points. On governance, the question on governance. The report's suggestions are really, when it comes to governance, in the empowerment dimension. So what the report suggests is that if the problems have to do with the policies that are not responding to the aspirations of the population, we have to find mechanisms of making leaders, decision makers more accountable to these aspirations. And so there are a range of policy recommendations that are suggested. Some are very simple and have to do with increased use of information and communication technologies, for example. Basic tools like giving to farmers in remote areas information about prices, mm-hmm. the prices at which produce is sold in major markets. This leaves leverage to farmers in remote areas when they're negotiating with the middle people. Others have to do more with empowerment of women, which is critical. The report has a lot of evidence that suggests that in Africa, women are really at a disadvantage, has a strong bias against women across a range of dimensions when it comes to access to inputs, agriculture inputs, when it comes to access to assets, especially land. And so just bringing parity when it comes to access to land and assets, so this empowerment dimension, that has to do with governance fundamentally, would go a long way towards making progress on the empowerment side. On the dynamics of international food prices, the way we read the evidence suggests that it's controversial the extent to which international capital markets influence increase in international food prices. It's an ongoing discussion. I'll just give you an example to illustrate the challenges. For example, in 2008, the food category that increased the most and that created really the major crisis was rice. Mm-hmm. And rice is really not tradable in future markets. There are no futures for rice. So it's very difficult to establish a close connection between what happened in international capital markets and what happened in international food prices. There's also some evidence in the other direction that there has been a growing taking of positions in future markets that are speculative in nature, as opposed to the traditional hedging function that these markets have. So it's a bit controversial, and the evidence is not clear one way or another. What is clear, though, is that there are underlying fundamental factors driving this volatility in food prices. They always occur when there are shocks to the supply side, droughts like the one we're seeing now in the U.S., and the drawdown in stocks that is reflected very quickly in food price in food price increases. So there is something fundamental going on here. On the colleague from Georgetown, it's not new. It's true. A lot of what's in the report, it's not new. And in fact, we as UNDP were a little bit anxious about how the FAO and other agencies would react to the report, because it's not within our mandate to work on agriculture. Even though they were very involved with and working closely with us, FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, mm-hmm. IFAD, and the World Food Programme, they were always very supportive. And in fact, after the report was launched, they came out and said, we're glad that UNDP is producing this report, because even though a lot of the things that are in the report we've been saying, now that UNDP is also saying it and linking it to development is amplifying these messages and is making them having more impact and heard from a different perspective. So they welcomed these messages quite a lot. And what I think the report is also making is making sure that food security is really a core development challenge. And you're right to say that often there is not a full understanding of the challenge that it is to link increases in production to improvement in well-being of people. Zambia is a good example where we've seen surplus, for example, in maize production over the last 2 years. And yet when you look at rural poverty rates, they haven't gone down as much. And this is recognized by the government. And the production has been supported quite strongly by a number of policies like fertilizers and price support. But it's not reaching the smallest of the smallholder farmers. It's reaching some smallholder farmers, but the largest smallholder farmers, not the smallest smallholder farmers. So as a result, rural poverty is not increasing. And so the challenge for policy is to look at these issues from a development perspective, and this is what UNDP is trying to do with this report, is to establish the links between food security and development.
Thank you.
Beth. I want to thank you for your question to come back to the issue of larger companies investing in land in Africa, and I wanted to give an example of Tanzania. Mm-hmm. One example of one of these outgrower schemes that we're working with is the Kilimanjaro rice plantation in southern Tanzania. And you see an investor's come in with a core farm that's 1,000 hectares and is working with 5,000 farmers in the surrounding areas and really helping them increase their access to inputs and to markets in a way that they really didn't have access to these improved technologies and the way to get their crops out to market. And it's still in the first year. And I don't have hard data to show you, but evidence is showing that there's higher yields on the smallholder farms than there are actually on the core nucleus farm. And so these farmers are very much benefiting. You're starting to see tin roofs go up and the rest. Mm-hmm. And I think that you're right in saying that, you know, it's really important to have the criteria to make sure that the types of investments that countries are supporting to come in are those that are going to benefit smallholders. And in Tanzania, you see very strong government leadership with the support of the private sector, forming the SAGCOT, the Southern Agricultural Growth Corridor of Tanzania, where this body oversees these private sector investments. And people have been turned down who are not showing how their investment will link to smallholders. And I think that's the type of investment that we need to see more of in Africa that can be very, very beneficial for smallholders. And I also just wanted to talk about, I think, what is new. I think one thing that we need to make sure that we're doing is our focus on agriculture. We're increasing resources across the board to focus on agriculture after many, many decades yes. of neglect in this area. So I think that that's one very important thing, that this increase in resources will start to have an impact. And also looking at it holistically, not just ag production, exactly. but linked with nutrition and the rest, because just having more food available doesn't really necessarily result in and declining hunger, which is very important.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Maybe I can comment on this issue of land. maybe take this privilege. I went to Malawi, and I've been telling my colleague, my fellow panelists that about this large research. My best case study is what is an investment by the Clinton Foundation, and they have a big farm in Malawi called they call it the Clinton Foundation Anchor Farm, and the idea is it covers the same issues that we have talked about here. The big thing with our farmers, small farmers, productivity issues relate to quality seeds, quality inputs, and linking to markets and markets in terms of outputs and finance. Mm-hmm. And what this what Clinton Foundation has done as an experiment is to set up a very big farm, which is commercial, but invest in high technology production of seeds, groundnut, soy, and maize. But also is linked to about 10,000 farmers, small farmers, and I'll be writing about this soon. And they connect them to the credit market, so they all get financing. They also link them to the buyer so that they aggregate the outputs. They sell to one. They get the best price, and they get the inputs, quality inputs, fertilizers and all that. So this type of model, to me, is a much, much better model because it's really... First of all, it's viable. It's not a gift. It's not like you are relying on aid. They actually have to pay for it. But the small farmers are well linked to the markets, but through the anchor farm. And I think that is I am considering this as one of my models that I have seen as leader working because I visited there just this year. Yes.
Just to add to that, I think there's evidence that opportunities have been abused in some places, and the approach has not been appropriate, and that indigenous, rural, poor people have suffered because of inequitable distribution of this land and of the ways in which the schemes have been developed. No doubt there's evidence of that. Equally, there's lots of evidence of schemes like the one he's talking about that are beginning to show a lot of progress and a lot of improvement. And what we should be worried about is how in our various involvements and in our various organizations we could assist with formulating the guidelines on many fronts on how these schemes can be developed equitably for the benefit of those for which we would like to advocate justice and fair play. And so the ideas that are coming forward in terms of links to market, in terms of their participation in making decisions, in which kinds of crops to be developed, everything that would be geared and directed towards income generation, sustained livelihoods, and poverty reduction, and food and nutrition security for the recipients and the participants in these schemes are what we should be concerned about. There are good examples that are going up, and as I mentioned, I give credit to one organization that I work with, this is Syngenta Foundation, that is helping to guide some of these projects. And they have examples of very, very good schemes that are working, rice schemes in Ghana, that are beginning to show a lot of progress.
Thank you.
So it's not all bleak.
Thank you very much. Let's take the last round of questions. So again, I'll start from the back. The gentleman who's been studying over there and come back this way, and I'll add up with you.
Hi, my name is Kevin Sudley. I'm with Wikistrat. We seem to have an ironic nexus of occurrences and developments.
Is it possible to speak a little bit?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me now?
Yeah, keep it closer.
Okay. We seem to have an interesting nexus of developments in food security and international development where there is a lack, you know, given the global economy, there is a lack of government investment in sustainability improvements, and the public-private partnerships are being emphasized, which is a good thing. But it seems that, as noted in your report and a UNEP report published in 2011 on agroecological improvements, that the best improvements for Africa are simply sharing traditional knowledge and utilizing natural and sustainable farming methods, not necessarily new industrialized technologies. So I'm wondering, what do you advise or what have you found in terms of simply helping Africans inform them each other as opposed to relying on private investment?
Okay. Okay, why don't you start with the gentleman? If you make them quick, the one next to you, if you make them very quick, I think the panelists will be able to respond broadly. I may not give you another chance.
I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consultant. How are you using the internet in your efforts?
So the use of technology in terms of communication, internet. Okay, good. The lady there, that lady, please.
Hi, I'm Faustine with Bread for the World. I appreciate all your comments that you shared this morning. One thing I'd just like to hear from you, and your based on your extensive experience with African agriculture, is the issue of land reform. And I think that this is a fundamental issue that unless and until we address it, food insecurity is continuing to be a big problem, especially now with new players in the sector. Thank you.
Very good. Land reform. Are the lady there? And then I think two more. And please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Sarah, and I'm a law student at Columbia. One question, I wanted to go back to the issue of governance, and this is particularly for USAID. What are you doing, if anything, to ensure against political capture? So a lot of the presentation focused on the idea that there's a failure of policy, and this is very closely, of course, related to the issue of governance. And so what are you doing to make sure that the contributions that you're making are not actually strengthening poor governments?
Okay. I think that gentleman and then the last one. Yeah, is you on? No?
Thank you. Can you hear me? My name is Gabriel Liza. I work for the FAO. Pedro, thank you so much for the report. You've done our work fantastically, so I appreciate that. My question is for Beth. On the new alliance, there are $3 billion from the private sector. Is that actually new money or money that was already earmarked for the project anyway? Thank you.
Okay. You didn't have a question. Okay, then I'll give Fred from the final question quickly.
It has been said that the African countries or some African countries lost the Green Revolution some decades ago. And now you have many African countries where the minerals, they are exporting a lot of minerals mainly to China. Don't you see the risk of a Dutch disease in some of these countries where it could be an appreciation of the exchange rate and a discourage of the agricultural sector despite these kind of measures? I'm thinking in countries like Nigeria, for instance, but some other countries could follow this path, that despite this kind of policies, really the exchange rate appreciates and they focus on minerals and not on agriculture.
Okay. I'll start from Eugene and come this way, but very quick.
I want to take the development and food security nexus issue and probably try and interpret what I thought was the thrust of the question, and that's the balance of emphasis on traditional approaches on sustaining soil fertility and the old sustainability issue as opposed to large-scale investments for the use of advanced technology in agriculture. Did I get the thrust of that question? Let us not go into romanticism here. We're not talking about the good old methods in the past that have left our farmers still poor and hungry. So, obviously, the obvious question is, what do our farmers need to increase their productivity? If it is traditional approaches or a combination of traditional approaches plus advanced technology or even genetically modified organisms, let us begin to assess the risks and the benefits of all of these and make our decisions based on those risks and benefits. Where technology or approaches or models are risky and do not necessarily benefit our constituencies, our smallholders, they must not be adopted. But where they do benefit and help our recipients, those whom we claim we want to help, to get out of poverty, to increase food security and nutrition security, by all means, let us adopt them once we have assessed the risks and benefits.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just I'll pick up on 3 points just to follow up quickly on what Eugene has said. I agree with this perspective, and this is what the report suggests. Agroecological approaches should be pursued, but, you know, organic farmers is what African farmers have been doing for a long time. And it's being difficult without the use of more fertilizer, irrigation and new seed varietals to pick up agriculture productivity. So, yes, whenever it's possible, it should be used. I should also mention that a lot of the evaluations that are done of these agroecological approaches suffer from some challenges. For example, if they encourage the use of organic fertilizer as opposed to chemical fertilizer, they often don't take into account that if one needs to use more organic fertilizer, more space is taken, more land is needed to integrate livestock into the farmers. So there are challenges in the way some of these agroecological approaches are being used. So the report suggests that it's important to pursue higher degrees of use of fertilizer, new seed varietals, and irrigation. And without this, it's going to be very, very difficult. Not because it's physically impossible, but it's economically very difficult to have the incentives to increase agriculture productivity. On land reform, it's a very important issue. But in Africa, it's important differently in different regions, as often happens with many issues in such a large and diverse continent. It's mostly an issue in southern and eastern Africa. In the rest of the continent, for the most part, land is fairly equally distributed. In fact, if you look at indicators of land distribution inequality, Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, has the lowest level of land inequality of all developing regions. But in southern and eastern Africa, for historical reasons, it is an important issue, and in some countries it's a hotly debated issue, as we all know. And the evidence suggests that it's important, as we've been discussing throughout, to ensure that smallholder farmers, which are as productive, often more productive than large farms, to have access to the means to increase their agricultural productivity, to have not only food, but access to income and to employment that they need to get out of poverty. The question on minerals, to me, it's very similar to the land issue, actually, because it just confirms that Africa has the resources, whether it's minerals, whether it's oil, whether it's land. It has the resources, so people are coming. Mm. So the challenge for the continent and for the international community is to strengthen the ability of Africa to negotiate these engagements in a way that it's equitable and it brings benefits to them. And we in UNDP are engaging in this capacity building effort to give more capacity to governments when they engage in negotiations. On the specific issue of the resource curse, which I think was what you were alluding to, it's true that for a lot of the countries in Africa, not all, you have the example of Botswana, which was very rich in mineral resources, diamonds in particular, and was able actually to use them for the most part in a good way. Many countries in Africa haven't done it. But actually, the best examples are perhaps in Asia, where you have Indonesia, that in the 60s and 70s was able to use the resources that was getting from oil and invest them in agriculture. So this was not only able to reduce poverty and develop the rural sector, but also to avoid Dutch disease, because it was not putting the money into the non-tradable sectors, but it was actually investing it in a productive sector. So if African countries follow a similar model approach, they can avoid the resource curse, I would think.
Thank you. Beth?
I just wanted to respond quickly to three of the questions. One is the new alliance, when we've talked about $3 billion in intended, publicly stated intended investment by the private sector. This is the first time these investments have been announced publicly. And it's the number is actually much higher than $3 billion, but others were not ready for announcement and not packaged as well. And I think it'll be higher. So we're really excited about that. I wanted to talk also about land reform. I think that we agree that it's a very, very important issue. And I think that we've seen a lot of advancement. I want to mention Ethiopia, where we're seeing commitment by the government to not to privatize land, but to issue certificates of secure tenure to landholders throughout the country. And this is a really big development in Ethiopia, where you know you've seen previously sort of redistribution of land happening every few years. Farmers not able to invest in their plots, never knowing when they might be uprooted and move somewhere else. And so I think that strong commitment is something that we saw in the policy framework for the new alliance cooperation framework with Ethiopia. We also saw it in Tanzania and other countries as well. And so it's a very important issue. It's very hotly debated, but we're making a lot of progress on agreeing on how we can move forward productively on this area. And this relates to the broader question of governance asked by a colleague over here, really trying to make sure that when we're looking into the new alliance, pushing out in a country, getting the three parties together to agree on taking action and really focusing the government on policies that will benefit the smallholder. And I think that that's the best thing that we can do right now is get concrete policy reforms on areas such as land tenure, which will have a very significant impact moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Very good. I think we are coming to an end, but I thought I could also mention the land reform issue. I think Pedro focused on inequalities, on ownership, and a lot of the Eastern and Southern Africa cases are really an issue of colonial heritage to a large extent. But then Beth also talked about the rights of use and security. I think the other big aspect there has to do with gender, and is related to the empowerment issue, which is the rights of women to own or at least user rights in land. And I believe that that's where we lag behind a lot. Even where we have free tenure, where land has been titled, I think we still need to do more in terms of even inheritance laws, in some cases, are quite horrible, that don't endow women with rights that would sort of incentivize long-term investments. And of course, we know that women are the ones in the land. And from all the studies we do, is that the more rights women have, the more the better children, the better fed children are. If you invest in women, actually, you do a lot. You get a lot of salutary benefits in terms of this productivity and also the well-being of children. So that's, I think, the way to go on these issues. So thank you very much. We have come to an end of this discussion, and I appreciate, I thank you very much, all the panelists. We had a guest who was not able to make it because of the flight connection from the Gates Foundation. Mm-hmm. As you know, Gates Foundation is very committed to agriculture in Africa, but we thought that all those issues that Gates would have talked about are already covered here by the panelists. So please give them a loud of applause. Thank you.